Committee to order. This is a joint meeting of our energy committees in the House and the Senate today. We're really excited to have a presentation on coal to liquids technology by Tyonic Native Corporation and Acelergy Corporation. Exciting new prospects, energy prospects here in our state. I'm going to go ahead and introduce the members that are here. I'm Senator McGuire. I have Chairwoman Sharice Millett from the House. Kyle Johansson, Representative Kyle Johansson, the Majority Leader in the House. Pete Peterson, Representative Pete Peterson. Representative Craig Johnson, who's the Resources Co-Chairman over in the House of Representatives. And we have other name tags here, hope to be joined by other members as they can today with their schedule. There are handouts for those of you that are online. We can follow up with you via email to get them to you. There are two of them today. The first is entitled Coal to Liquids Plant, Tyonic Location, and it's a yellow handout. The second is from Acelergy Energy Corporation, and it's a larger packet. We can get those to you. But without further ado, I had on here John McClellan first, but it looks yes, okay. So we'll have John McClellan with Tyonic Native Corporation come forward first and tell us about the project. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator. I would like to thank the committee for inviting us. What we would like to do today is talk about a coal to liquids project for Alaska and West Cook Inlet, but also explain how the state of Alaska can help enable that project. What I'd like to do is take 4 or 5 minutes and sort of set the stage for the technical presentation. See if I can figure out how to make the computer work here. The give you a geographic orientation and then walk you through the coal to liquids project for West Cook Inlet over the last couple of years, how it's kind of waxed and waned. This map shows Cook Inlet, but it's the point of the map is to show the coal that's available in the Susitna Coal Province. I'm told that the Susitna Coal Province is the second largest bituminous coal deposit in the world. It pretty much wraps all around Cook Inlet, but the highest value coal happens to lie right around Tyonic's property. And Tyonic Native Corporation is an Alaska village corporation under the Native Claim Settlement Act. Tyonic Native Corporation has 200,000 acres of land that's pretty much scattered the full length of West Cook Inlet, all the way from the Talkeetna Mountains to Mount St. Augustine. That's a distance of about 150 miles. And Bureau of Indian Affairs has a term of art, it's called area of influence, and the regulatory agencies use that in permitting. They call on the native community that's in the area of influence in the permitting. And Tyonic's area of influence is all of West Cook Inlet. And if you think about it for a minute, the native village of Tyonic, community of 200, is the only organized town in all of West Cook Inlet. And that's an area larger than the whole Kenai Peninsula. Tyonic is a surface landowner, but doesn't own any mineral rights. The coal belongs to the regional corporation on Tyonic lands, but at the village of Tyonic, there are significant coal deposits surrounding the village, and there are 4 coal leases already in place. And then there's a lot of area that contains coal that is not leased, that still belongs to the Department of Natural Resources, the state of Alaska. In all, the leases, the coal leases around Tyonek, contain over 2 billion tons of this high-quality bituminous coal. This slide shows a proposed 80,000 barrel per day coal to liquids plant using coal from one of these leases, about 10 miles from the village of Tyonek, to a site that was designated by the Tyonek Native Corporation as an industrial park. This slide comes directly from the Sasol presentation, and Sasol is a coal to liquids company that was considering locating a coal to liquids plant here. I'll point out the blue, the power plant in the upper right-hand corner of this slide, is on there for a reason. A coal to liquids plant is exothermic, gives off a lot of heat, and part of the coal to liquids project would be to put in a waste heat to electric energy conversion. In this case, it would be 400 megawatts of power could be generated by an 80,000 barrel per day coal to liquids plant. And it's a lot of power, over half of what the grid, the rail belt grid needs. But it's almost equal to, equivalent to the Beluga power plant that is way past its service life and needs to be put on reserve or standby status, and a more current power source replace it. Typical costs for a waste heat conversion power plant are about 5.5 cents per kilowatt hour for produced costs. So it's very economic electric power that would be a side product of a coal to liquids plant, and it's independent of the cost of fuel. This photograph shows the industrial park and the existing dock at North Forelands, where the coal to liquids plant would be located. A lot of people aren't aware that there is a dock there and an industrial park. A run through the coal to liquids history. This is from my perspective and in my own words, but Richard Peterson and his Alaska Natural Resources to Liquids project was promoting a Beluga CTL project with Sasol, and things were looking pretty good in 2008. Sasol had planned on visiting Alaska and really start the project process. At the same time, the U.S. Air Force made a declaration that by the year 2016, half of their jet fuel needs would be supplied by coal to liquids products. And that's a pretty ambitious statement for the Air Force, since there was no production of coal to liquids in North America at that time. To my knowledge, there still is no production plant for coal to liquids. The U.S. Air Force also was advertising to build, own, and operate a coal to liquids plant, and had a contest for the location of that plant that they were going to finance and build. And several states responded to that competition. Alaska did not, but Tyonek Native Corporation did. We actually went to meet with the Air Force and the Pentagon and pitched to them a Tyonek coal to liquids location. At that time, we thought we got some agreement out of the Air Force that Tyonek location was the most cost-effective coal to liquids site in North America, and that's in part due to its geographic location and the fact that the fuel source and the plant were both at Tidewater. There's no overland shipping of product or of the plant. So things were looking pretty good for a short while in 2008. Then Congressman Miller of California slipped in some legislation that prevented the Air Force from funding coal-to-liquids plant by cutting their ability to finance projects to 5 years instead of 20. And then after that happened, the Air Force said they weren't going to finance a coal-to-liquids project, but they were seeking public-private partnerships. Basically, they would supply the Air Force base site and wanted private developers to come in and do it. Congressman Miller of California then put in more legislation through Congress that said that coal-to-liquids plants had to match the or better the efficiency of a petroleum refining system. And that pretty much killed the ability of a Fischer-Tropsch process, which Sasol was using, to meet those kind of efficiencies. So after a great deal of interest in the first part of 2008, Sasol sort of went quiet. We heard, and there were several Sasol projects planned for the lower 48, and Sasol pretty much turned their back on all of them, and turned their back, from my perspective, on all their U.S. projects. There was so much demand worldwide for Sasol plants that they didn't need to come to the U.S. and try and overcome those congressional obstacles. So what we did at Tyonek, still seeking a coal-to-liquids plant, is we, in 2009, went out and searched for a coal-to-liquids partner, someone who would be willing to come to West Cook Inlet and start developing a coal-to-liquids plant. Through mutual friends in Washington, D.C., Tyonek was introduced to a company called Excelergy, and we found that Excelergy had new technology. The Fischer-Tropsch technology is back in the 1920s, pre-World War II, and it's been bettered. And Excelergy has the best available technology, and you'll see some of the results of that better technology. We brought Excelergy to Alaska in 2009. I introduced them to ADA, Alaska Energy Authority, and those organizations seemed enthused about Excelergy. And the first step in creating an Excelergy project would be to certify the Tyonek coals to the U.S. Air Force. And one of Tyonek's prerequisites is that the state participate in that certification. So Tyonek prepared a proposal and said that they would require a matching grant from the state of $500,000 to do the certification. And we could not find any source within the state of Alaska or any program that would fund that. And so we spent about a half year trying to figure out how to fund this startup cost and couldn't do it. And about at the end of that time period, we came to the realization that the Department of Natural Resources would be the real beneficiary of certifying Tyonek coals, because basically all the coal in West Cook Inlet is pretty much owned by the Department of Natural Resources. Even if it's under lease, they would benefit by royalty. In early 2010, Excelergy was still excited about developing a project with us in West Cook Inlet when they bumped into the state of Pennsylvania at a conference, and it took, I'm told, It took about 3 weeks for the state of Pennsylvania to come up with $10 million to Excelergy to do a similar plant in the state of Pennsylvania. So that's where Excelergy's been putting their time and effort for these last few months, until the Senate Bill 220, I believe, contained an Emerging Energy Technology Fund that would or could provide the startup funding to certify the coals. So that's where we're at now. We have, this is the title page off of the proposal that we are prepared to submit under that Emerging Energy Technology Fund. Notice that the proposal is submitted by Tyonic Native Corporation. Tyonic Native Corporation is not charging any kind of fee or administrative portion. It'll be a complete pass-through to the actual certification process. And we look forward to the enabling regulations and the appointment of a board and the RFP to start this process. That's all I have as an introduction. I'd like to turn it over to Rocco Fiato, who's the Vice President of Technology for Excelergy.
So just a couple questions from us. First of all, thank you so much, John, and many of the members sitting right here were privy to an early presentation that you gave a few years ago when you were first looking at this concept, and some of us met with officials at the Pentagon as well in D.C., not only on your behalf, but on behalf of Alaskans and the potential for the Fischer-Tropsch technology to be successful. And it's been disappointing to see it become such a political football in the U.S. Congress, because I do think it is the kind of technology that could really move the state forward. I know Representative Noah has a question. I have one, first of all, which is, how many jobs do you think that this project would yield here in Alaska?
Okay. I'm going to let Rocco answer that. I think he has that in a chart in his presentation. My knowledge is somewhat dated, but at that time it was several thousand jobs during construction and several hundred jobs during the operation of the plant.
Okay, because Senator Wilkowski and I went in our travels in South Africa, that was the general idea for any kind of a bio coal to liquids plant with the Fischer-Tropsch technology, was about 2,000 jobs for the construction part, about 500 year-round, and at a cost of, it was roughly $5 billion was what we were looking at for a 50,000 barrel a day Syncrude facility. So it'll be nice to hear the comparison. Representative Miller?
Thank you. I just have a question. You had talked about some enabling legislation or regulations. Are you talking on a federal level or a state level for the project?
The Emerging Energy Technology Fund.
Oh, is that
fund?
What you're referring to? Okay.
Right. That is state of Alaska, I believe, authored by...
Yep. That was in our bill, and we want to thank Bert Stedman in absentia here, because he became a believer in it, and we pushed it for a couple of years, our energy group here, and in a very unique move, we convinced him to capitalize it in the same year that it was created, and that's been wonderful, because that's helped us to bring on additional Denali Fund money, and we're currently, and just I throw this out to committee members, we're currently seeking, we wrote the Emerging Energy Technology Fund in such a way that matches can come in from angel investors, private sector investors, universities, nonprofits. That was the goal, is that it would be seed money and a place for these funds to sit within the committee, of course, overseeing the handout of that seed money for these really exciting projects. But so right now we're just shy of $5 million in the fund, and we know you'll be applying, and we hope you keep us posted in that process, because it'll be interesting to see a company go through, a group like yours go through it, and how they fared and what they thought of the process. So just want to say thank you very much for being here today, and we'll go ahead and bring up Rocco then. And any other questions for John McClellan before he leaves? Okay.
I'd like to add that our proposal will only be for $125,000. from some of the emerging energy technology.
Yeah, you'd hope. It is a little embarrassing, but we're trying to track down what happened with respect to the $10 million partnership, because as you saw, it took 3 weeks for the government of Pennsylvania to figure out what an exciting prospect that would be, and I'm not quite sure who the decision makers were that didn't see that opportunity for Alaska, but we'd like to talk to you more. Representative Stoltz has a question, and I also want to just note that right after the start of the meeting, we were joined by Representative Chris Tuck, Senator Wilikowski, and Representative Stoltz. So, Representative Stoltz?
Madam Chair, do you have any idea of how much mental health land trust is within this and within this unit and possible benefits for that constituency to be?
Okay. The question is on mental health lands trust and what they would receive. Around Tyonek, one of the leases, the one that's being developed right now, a coal mining lease, has been transferred over to the Mental Health Lands Trust. And my understanding is that the same contract with Department of Natural Resources for royalties was transferred over also. So whatever DNR receives in royalties would go to Mental Health Trust for that coal mine.
Mixing issues a little bit. Yeah. It's really not, because whether it's university land bill or the mental health trust, we always run into if we want to fully fund these, but God forbid we erode a view shed or something. And we run into values clashes, and it's a serious subject for me. The legislature, I think the House passed a unanimous resolution encouraging the mental health trust to look for it as a long-term sustainability lesson. And we run into that. And it's been a frustration ever since I've been a freshman here. I've pushed that issue, and we have people that want to make it. But, I have a passion for the mentally disabled, whether it's the brain injury to autism, or we go through all that whole. But we get a chance to help them. We always know something else is more important. So a little bit of soaps, but it's not something I haven't been consistent on and have had a passion on. So. I'm very excited there is a mental health trust beneficiary aspect to this. So thank you for that indulgence.
No, excellent point. I think that's, the mental health trust, they're managing their assets more like a real estate investment company now, but these are the kind of opportunities where you could see a really great partnership with visible beneficiaries right at the outset. So that's great. Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you. For purposes of, you talked about royalty. Would this, have you contemplated whether this royalty would be based on figuring this as mining, coal, or gas, or oil?
Okay. My understanding is that the coal mine itself, if it's on state land, would pay the DNR royalty for the mine. The coal-to-liquids project that would use the coal would be on Tyonek lands, and would be pay taxes as any other industrial user. But I don't believe the coal to liquids plant would pay any royalties to the state for the use of the coal. Only the mine where the coal is sold to the plant would do that. Did that answer your question?
Well, and as you guys go forward, you've probably thought about this, but a white paper that showed for Alaskans, the potential benefit in royalties, mental health trust land, et cetera, I think is a really great way to get people behind your project. So, thank you. Oh, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, going into the Congressman Miller's stipulations, one of them is the better efficiency than the petroleum process right now. Using the, and I think you were saying that Excelergy has the most advanced technology right now. What is the efficiency factor in comparison to petroleum? How much further do we have to go?
I think Excelergy, it's part of their presentation, and I'll explain that, but I think they bettered it. They're actually more efficient, much more efficient than petroleum refining.
Any further questions for John? Thank you so much. Okay. So now we'll call up Rocco Fiato with the Synergy Corporation. He's the Chief Technologist and the Vice President for Business Development and Planning. And just a brief little note about his company. Synergy is a global leader in producing high-performance fuels at less cost to both the environment and the customer, utilizing domestic sources of feedstock to produce fuel so that's less CO2 than traditional refining methods while producing 20% more energy per pound. So welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to meet you finally.
Yes.
And let me say, I've been mostly conversant with folks in Washington for the last 3 years. I've learned to have a lot of respect for some of the Senate leadership in the coal-bearing states, and it's been gratifying to see those people take leadership in helping the U.S. develop serious jobs that stay in the U.S., that help the U.S. economy and basic working people here. And I know you're doing that, Senator, for the state of Alaska, and I am very respectful and appreciative of it. Just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you. Our whole committees have been hard at work on it. Thank you.
What I'd like to do today, my time is short. We have approximately 54 minutes, and I'm going to take you through several segments of an update around Excelergy, the corporation, around the technology we're trying to develop and advance here in the U.S. and globally. And around some of our thoughts on what could be a really terrific opportunity, we believe, for the state of Alaska and for the U.S. with regard to four important factors. We divvy up the world and the prospect of new alternative fuel technology in at least four performance parameters, the first being energy security, the ability to provide energy security, in our case, to the U.S. What that basically means for us is the ability to use domestic resources. And in our case, we're going to look at coal as the primary resource, supplemented by biomass and or natural gas. We look at resource sustainability. This is not looked at by a lot of folks who bring technology either here or to the lower 48. And that basically looks at land use, the impact on land use, water use, the amount of water needed to produce a single barrel of alternative fuel, and ultimately on the ability of one to institute a new technology and sustain it over a long period of time to impact national energy volumes, the kind of energy consumption that our country is used to. We also pay very strict attention to environmental issues. In our case, if you start with coal, you usually end up not faring very well in Washington. Coal is a carbon-rich resource. Anything you do with coal will produce a lot of CO2. And today, and in the pending energy bill, Waxman-Markey amendments called Section 526, if you are not able to produce an alternative fuel with a greenhouse gas footprint at least better than refining a petroleum to analogous product, you're not allowed to sell that fuel to the U.S. military. We've worked very hard, and I'll tell you today on how we've worked to reduce the overall greenhouse gas footprint in our technology to be at 80% or lower of that of refining to analogous products. And then finally, and I'll tell you a great quick cute story from T. Boone Pickens, but finally it needs to be economically viable. You have to be able to compete with crude oil at natural crude oil prices. If you think you're going to get into this business and get subsidies or other sort of tax benefits, that may work for a little while, but it will not allow you to be in a sustainable mode in the alternative fuel sector. So those four parameters are ones that our corporation, and I should add, we're all seasoned veterans from the oil and gas business. I spent over 25 years at ExxonMobil myself. Others in our corporation have been either at GM or other major energy companies. And the idea of instituting a new energy technology without meeting those four criteria is unrealistic. So as you listen to our story and as others who will undoubtedly come to Alaska and make their own presentations to you, look to see if they're matching up on all four criteria. That's the critical factor and the one I'll tell you about today. T. Boone Pickens spoke at a Wall Street Journal conference that I spoke at a little over a year ago. And he tried to convey the three rules of getting into alternative fuels that his father had taught him. And I always quote the story because I find it to be quite terrific and on target. And T. Boone said the first rule in the alternative fuels business is if it can't make money, the other two rules don't matter. All right, that's basically what he said. And you need to pay attention to that. Folks are going to come to you, I guarantee it. They're going to come to you seeking support from the state and subsidies and tax credits and all sort of things like that. It's not the real deal. You need to find a technology, an option that will, in fact, stand on its own, that will meet the energy security needs, sustainability, and environmental responsiveness needs. And if you do, those are the technologies that you as a state, I submit, need to help our country move forward to really help it advance and be competitive in the world. I spend half of my time in China, and I don't have to make this sort of a plea to the folks in China. They know this already, they get it, and they are putting in place modern technology, every bit as good as we have, and they're doing a lot of it, and they will get a competitive upper hand by doing that. So I think it's a good wake-up call. And now that I've spent 4 minutes describing the background, let me get into my presentation. So today's talk is going to go through these areas, a general intro, and I'll go quickly through the front end. I'm from New York, so I talk a little fast. If you have questions, certainly that are penetrating questions, by all means, we'll deal with them as they come. I'll take you through an overview of our technology, and we call it ICBTL. It's a little inside joke with the Air Force. The first three letters of that used to be followed by an M. And our idea is that what we're trying to do is to develop a new technology based on coal biomass conversion. I will tell you about some of our China programs. These are important. We're bringing a very high-level delegation from the Chinese government to the U.S. in December. We may stop through here, depending on the weather and our timing, but the Chinese are very interested not only in developing these sort of technologies for China, but they're very interested in looking at them for offshore application. They're very interested in being investors in offshore. And in an enlightened world, hopefully we're emerging into, Chinese investment is not necessarily a bad thing. So an open mind on that would be great. I'll go into the Pennsylvania case study. We think they probably represent the ultimate right now in at least internally having broken down the Republican-Democrat kind of thinking. They don't have that with regard to resource development. They are truly trying a bipartisan approach. In a relatively short time, we got total unanimity on both sides of the Senate and the House and the governor's office to help us push this ICBTL demo project in Pennsylvania. I think Alaska, and I'll tell you why I think you guys ought to be up there with them, the main point on all this, on cost sharing, is for you to demonstrate the state's interest and sincerity and seriousness about these technologies. We're backed by Goldman Sachs and others who have lots of money. It's not a matter of the money. It's a matter of demonstrating the willingness to support a concept. So we'll talk about Pennsylvania. And then finally, some of our ideas on taking the Tionic project forward. Quick background, we are the leaders in CBTL technology. Our corporation has licensed out technologies from ExxonMobil, from Raytheon, and others who are developing so-called indirect conversion and biomass conversion technologies. In each of those areas, we believe and we think the U.S. Department of Defense, and I'll tell you some of the programs we have underway with them, also agrees that we have, in fact, got state-of-the-art platforms in those individual technology areas. What our corporation is doing is integrating those into a novel, efficient platform for converting the resource into clean either gasoline, diesel, or jet. We have a unique ability on jet fuel, which is why we're here in Cook Inlet. You all consume over 65,000 barrels a day of jet fuel just around this area, and that's a very important strategic asset, both as a customer and ultimately as being representative of what's happening in our country. We are aligning ourselves with clean coal project developers. We have started discussions with Tionic and some of those folks, but basically we're a technology provider. We will bring in project developers to help advance some of these ideas we're talking about. We have very experienced people who have even grayer hair than I do. And finally, we're supported by DOE, a group across DOD, and then a series of leading investors that you see on this chart. Quickly, if you look at Stanford Research Institute's most recent assessment of global energy use, if you think of worldwide energy use in terms of oil equivalent, obviously we use it in all different forms. Each year, the world uses 3 cubic miles of oil equivalent. Cubic mile, I am told, imagine the landmass of Washington, D.C. filled to a level of 8 feet with oil. That's a cubic mile of oil. The world uses three of those each year. If you look at the distribution, coal is 0.8 cubic miles equivalent. If you look at what it would take to replace coal, it starts with an over $7 trillion investment, so the national debt times seven, and would require the combinations that are shown there. What the message is, it's unrealistic to think you're going to simply dismiss coal as an important element of the overall energy mix. If you look at the distribution of coal in the world, North America has more energy in the form of coal than the Middle East does in oil and gas. And Alaska has 50% roughly of North America's coal. So if you think about Alaska as a resource, it has a lot of other resources, but coal is one of the most strategic resources present in this state. If you think about biomass and the options with biomass, and this is where this one blows up. I shouldn't say that here, but anyhow, it doesn't work very well. If you look at the land masses required to produce 10% of U.S. liquid needs, it turns out one-tenth of our liquid needs is roughly the amount of daily consumption of jet fuel. If you look at the land masses required for these different seed crops, soybean and corn, you find that it's prohibitive. You can't do it. It doesn't equate. So you start looking at the different options. We have developed an option that has the basically lowest land use, highest overall thermal efficiency, and it's our ICBTL process using coal and taking the processed CO2 and converting it to algae, which we then convert to fuel and or to synthetic fertilizer, either of which is an offset of traditional petroleum or natural gas production technology. With that, in the fully integrated scheme, we can achieve over 90% effective thermal efficiency to product. Obviously, you can say it's cheating because we're using sunlight. But in reality, if you look at the energy content of the feed, over 90% is coming out as useful product. If you look at the other technologies individually, coal or bio, the coal is Sasol, the bio is UOP, Boeing, and others right now. They're either very expensive, have low thermal efficiency, below 50%, produce a non-optimal product mix, typically a lot of light hydrocarbons that you need to dispose of. And if you're here in Alaska, that's not an easy thing to do. They have severe greenhouse gas emissions problems, and in the case of biofuel, they have that large land area requirement. If you look at our technology option, and we've spent over 3 years putting this all together, and it's some of the smartest people I've ever worked with, and there are very smart people out of Exxon, although I know sometimes that may not be considered to be a good thing here. Shoes or books will be flying, but nevertheless, our technology has 80%+ overall thermal efficiency, uses less than 10% of the biomass to liquids land area. Most importantly for the military, it meets Section 526 greenhouse gas, and it is cost competitive with current day crude prices. What is it? I'm just going to blow through all this so that I can be done by 3 o'clock. It's a three-step process. The MCL, microcatalytic liquefaction technology, was developed at Exxon. It took over 30 years to develop. It basically cost them very significant sums of money to develop this into a commercially ready technology. It takes coal and literally, with hydrogen, converts it to something called cycloparaffinic fuels. That's important later for the Air Force. I'll tell you why in a few minutes. The technology does also co-produce CO2. We take the CO2 through a technology platform being developed by Raytheon, who's one of our partners, and another company out of Colorado called A to B Carbon Capture, and we convert it with over 90% efficiency into algal biomass, which is bifurcated into something called triglyceride fatty acids, or you would call them vegetable oil, and the non-TGFA, dried algal biomass. Those two streams are split, one sent to the gasifier to produce hydrogen for liquefaction, the other stream sent to something called either catalytic hydrodeoxygenation isomerization, which is a fancy name for transforming vegetable oil into isoparaffinic fuels, or the Sasol-type technology, Fischer-Tropsch. That fully integrated scheme is the one that has the potential for over 90% overall thermal efficiency, and it meets those other four criteria we talked about. Shown here in different, simpler form, if you look at Sasol or other, Shell and others have offered this conventional Fischer-Tropsch-based technology from a single ton of dry, ash-free coal, you can produce 2.5 or so barrels of fuel and 1.6 tons of CO2. If you go through the sequence, you'll see progressively more fuel, less CO2, ultimately to the point in a fully integrated ICBTL scheme where you produce less CO2 per barrel than you do from petroleum refining, and you produce over 5 barrels of liquid fuel from a ton of coal. Later, on your own, it's just an interesting exercise. Take the numbers that you were told for Tyonek bituminous coal alone and do the math, and you'll understand the strategic significance of this. What are we doing now? We have 2 major initiatives, a North America initiative and a China-Asia-Pacific initiative. This one, I will tell you, can move faster, and we are moving as fast as we can in China on so-called hybrid projects. The Chinese have built over 30 basic Fischer-Tropsch projects that they have now looked at and understand that hybridizing those with our technology will, in fact, improve efficiency, improve economics. So we're looking at that sort of approach in China. It's aimed at gasoline and diesel, fungible fuels that the Chinese have a voracious appetite for. In North America, it's a different push. It's mostly Department of Defense-oriented. It's aimed at high-performance fighter aircraft fuel, so-called JP-8. We're working on the base fuel requirements for the Air Force, and then also for Jet-A, the sort of fuel that would be used by commercial carriers at Anchorage International. And then we have some exotic programs, kind of Skunk Works-type programs, looking at next-generation fighter aircraft that have very unusual thermal management issues. So those programs are U.S.-centric. The reason we're looking here is largely because of our relationships with folks in the Air Force and their interest around Elmendorf and the whole Alaska story, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with. The other reason we're interested here is in our discussions with folks at FedEx and some of the commercial carriers, we fully understand the logistics issues of Anchorage International. It has a terrific opportunity, if, and it's you guys, frankly, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it's you guys ultimately who have to do and the right calls on this. You have the opportunity to make Anchorage International a long-term, sustainable, terrific resource, or you can blow it. And it's really going to be up to you guys to how you manage your energy resources as to what the outcome is there. But you can be the low-cost producer of jet fuel and keep that business not only sustained but growing if you do it right, in my opinion. The other story, and this came from Tim Edwards out of AFRL and their assessment of what the opportunities, but you can see the Air Force requirements in Alaska are significant, but they're dwarfed by Anchorage International. It really is the big dog on the block. This is just some of the initial data. We've shown that our biofuel alone and our MCL fuel alone meet military JP-8 specs. We are now aiming to take and combine those. And there's later, more complicated elements. I'm not going to go into all of them. But the ability to uniquely produce the isoparaffins, that's a class of molecules that comes out of Fischer-Tropsch or the bioprocessing, and cycloparaffins, which uniquely come from the Exxon technology, and combine those in the right proportions and with the right molecular composition, gets us to the new fuel, for example, for the F-35, where it has very special thermal management requirements. And Lockheed is aware of this, and in our program with AFRL, which is now underway, that will be one of the certification programs planned to certify our blends for use in F-35. The trick in all this, and it's not a trick, it's just what we call molecular management. Coal has a unique molecular structure. It is not found in natural gas. It is not found in biomass. If you surgically, catalytically transform coal into liquids, you can produce very specific molecules called cycloparaffins. And any organic chemist will tell you they have very high thermal stability, exceptionally high thermal stability for advanced fighter aircraft. Similarly, they produce aromatic molecules that have other unique so-called fit-for-purpose functions, lubricity, seal swell, the compatibility within the fuel system on an aircraft to keep the metal parts intact, to keep the rubbing parts not from scouring and wearing on one another, and finally, the isoparaffin components. And it's managing the composition across those 3 families of organic molecules that ultimately is the key to being able to play in the Air Force world of synthetic versions of their current suite of fuels. That's the program we have underway with AFRL. A few weeks ago, TARDEC, the U.S. Army Research Lab, signed up with us to do certification on the same suite of formulations. And just this morning, I was told the U.S. Navy will be signing up with us. We have a truly legitimate and novel platform for military fuel applications. If you want to see some of the results, this is work that was done by one of our consultants, Harold Schubert at Penn State. But basically, looking at just the classes, and these are model compound studies, but it illustrates the point. In an F-35, it's going to have very unique weapons. When you fire the weapon, it's going to emit over a megawatt of heat that needs to be quickly removed so that you can fire the weapon again if you missed on your first shot. Energy weapons, laser-type devices. If you look at a fuel now in that service as a heat transfer fluid, it thermally decomposes. It starts breaking up and going back to form carbon. This is shown here. If you look at these cycloparaffinic fuels, you can actually not only use them for the 5-hour sort of target requirement, but for 10 hours and still have a clear, although slightly coloring fuel, but one that would more than meet the Air Force specs on heat transfer and sustainability in flight. The program we have underway with AFRL now is aimed at certifying something called fully synthetic JPA. Up until now, everyone in the U.S. who's been playing in this sector is limited to a 50-50 blend, synthetic plus petroleum derived, and that is the rule right now. We're working, and the Air Force hopes to have certified our fully synthetic, meaning all from coal plus biomass, by first quarter of 2013. And once we have that certification, that will be not only unique, but will create an ability for Excelergy and the resource holders in the states that we work with to get into very actively this whole U.S. Military fuel market. We've been very successful recently. Pennsylvania, Montana, and North Dakota all have endorsed and are now partly sponsoring. The trick here is Goldman and the other investors want to see state commitment. We get it in Montana. They are willing to sponsor one-third of the effort to build a coal-only plant. We'll do that with the Crow in Billings. In North Dakota, we're doing a project with Tesoro. Actually, Tesoro will be one of our target groups for Alaska. And Tesoro in North Dakota is aimed at the bioconversion step. Pennsylvania right now, which is just at the front-end feasibility stage, but they've agreed up through the $10 million in a gated process, which we would recommend you do also, not only with us, but others. But in a gated process, Pennsylvania will ultimately have the first fully integrated demo plant. And the target for Alaska is not to build a demo plant here, and we're formulating a formal plan is to build an 8,000 barrel a day Pioneer project here. That's our plan for Alaska. The advanced, this is a mouthful, but this was Senator Dorgan, and he's a good guy, so we go with it. Advanced Tactical Fuels Mandan Biomass Refinery Project is what we've basically got underway in North Dakota. It is with Tesoro. Tesoro, I think you know, is very interested in this whole concept of integration of either coal with refining or biomass with refining, so they're on board already in that regard. The project here, which I was just told by my guys down in Houston, originally was the initial project was 100 barrel a day. I think they're already now moving that up to maybe 500 barrel a day. And the desire is to get into meaningful quantities of production for something called Title III of the Defense Production Act, which is part of the U.S. Department of Defense's outlet, if you will, for bringing in new technology. And Senator Baucus, whom I will actually get you all in contact with, has been pushing to reinstate the 20-year military contract capability. It's a killer. If they can only sign a 5-year purchase agreement, it doesn't help us or anybody for that matter. If they can sign a 20-year purchase agreement and obviously stipulate product specs, cost, et cetera, and index it, it works a lot better. So we're working with the Montana and North Dakota and hopefully soon the Alaska folks to try to get that reinstituted so that the military can sign a 20-year purchase agreement for a fuel that they deem suitable for their purposes.
Yeah.
And that's what we're now trying to work into this whole thing in North Dakota. In China, and I'm doing pretty well on time, In China, we have a different approach, but it's going to be one that's very synergistic, we think, with what we're doing here in the U.S. In China, there are over 30 projects right now that have a minimum price tag of $1.2 billion U.S. each. There are over 30 of those projects that have gone up already. The Chinese government basically is looking at the same issues, the same set of issues as the U.S. government. And I'll tell you frankly, and this is not a secret, the U.S. military is actually trying to find a way to liaise with the Chinese military in this sector. They believe that a liaison and collaboration and cooperation in synthetic fuels is a good thing to do, because the belief is that either water or oil will be the source of World War III, fundamentally. So there's been a lot of cooperation and support, frankly, from the Department of Defense to do this kind of work, so we've been encouraged and have been doing it. Others have also. And we've linked up both with commercial parties in China, with the Shenhua, Datang. They're one of the electric power producers, but they're now looking for alternative outlets for their coal. Yangquang, all these are state-owned enterprises, meaning it's really the Chinese government. But strangely, they're all getting competitive. So even though they're government-run entities, they are competing with one another, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. We're working with them to identify project opportunities. Our best lead right now, and we actually have a formal memo of understanding being worked, is with Excelergy and Sinfuels China. These are the folks who've been most successful in implementing new technology in China, and they have basically offered us, and we offer to you, if you're interested, seriously, we will take you to China to any of three of their major strategic programs so that you can see an actual operating state-of-the-art coal-to-liquids plant. It's not like, I guarantee you, it's not like anything that's in your mind. They're as clean as the streets are here. The air is as clean as it is here, truly. Need to see that, because I think with that, you'll come away with a different sense of what it means to do coal to liquids. There's too much negative press around coal, and it just causes you to have this bad idea. It's like lump of coal for Christmas, raking over the coals, all these kind of things. It's not good. You need to have a different view of coal, and you can get it when you see some of these facilities running. You'll see it firsthand. In addition to working with the commercial entities, we're working with and have forged relations, formal relations, with the Beijing Research Institute of Coal Chemistry. And we have a facility there now being built up. It'll be fully operational end of fourth quarter. We're working with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, both the Shanghai Research Institute and the Institute in Shaanxi Province. This is the largest research institute sponsored by the Chinese government for doing coal conversion research, and we have a strategic relationship with them and with BRIC, and our plan is to use them as our direct liaison with the government whilst we try to identify our commercial partners in China. Those folks will be with us in December, and as I said, we may, depending on schedule and weather, be up here to meet with some of you all again. This goes in, you can read this on your own, it goes into all the details of what we're doing, but essentially, the programs at BRIC start with a large production facility that we get into early, and it eventually evolves into a testbed facility for Asia-Pacific coal conversion. We have already received expressions of interest from the Australians, from the Australian Energy Group, from Indonesians for their coal resources, and we will be doing all of that testbed work at BRIC in Beijing so that we can centralize and then hopefully advance it in the most efficient way possible. This is where we will take you if you come over to visit with us. It's to the Yitai project in basically northeastern China. It's a hybrid facility. It's not a hybrid facility yet. It is currently a 4,000 barrel a day FT plant, which Sinfuels China hopes to hybridize. The economics on that, again, for some of the folks in the audience, I know you guys are very conversant here, the economics are very attractive for a 5,000 barrel a day hybrid. The numbers here will equate to what you may have in your mind for Fischer-Tropsch pipes at 10 times scale. If you scale this up to 10 times scale, it looks way, way better than anything you've seen to date. The reason for that is that our technology requires a minimum amount of gasification. Fischer-Tropsch from Sasol and others requires a large amount. In fact, all of the coal has to be gasified. Once you invoke that requirement, you need to produce oxygen, pure oxygen, to gasify it, and you need to build very expensive equipment in order to carry out that transformation. We basically try to avoid this stuff. And that's the difference between what we're offering and what you've seen probably to date. In Pennsylvania, moving along, what we have basically is a strong interest on the part of the state of Pennsylvania. And I would say they've taken kind of a leadership role here. It's not been a situation where we've had to push, other than with the, initially with the DEP, and I think we not only successfully negotiated that, but I think we now have the Department of Environmental Protection as one of our strongest backers. But we had to approach them in three of the major criteria that we talked about. On energy security, they're looking for, obviously, Pennsylvania coal use, but they're also looking at the sustainability on land, water, and processed feedstock. In environmental area, they're not only looking to avoid what's called carbon capture and sequestration. The studies that have been done out of MIT, if you have not looked, and if you're interested in this area, you need to look at those. But CCS is prohibitively expensive, and also, for example, when you apply carbon capture and physical sequestration with a power plant, it actually causes you to need to generate 25% more power just to take care of CO2, and all you're doing with it is physically burying it underground, literally. That's all you're doing, and hoping it stays there. Our approach is to avoid that as much or altogether, because we think that's a dumb idea, frankly. It's costly, it's energy inefficient, and our approach is to basically replace this with something we call CCR, carbon capture and recycle. And that's one of the other main differentiating features. They want to meet Section 526, just as the U.S. government does. They want high thermal efficiency. Coal use today is sub 50% thermal efficiency. It's a terrible waste of a good resource. Beneficial use of CO2. We do that. I'll tell you how. And they want to do something else that may be unique to Pennsylvania, but as more I learn about Alaska, it sounds like there are actually some interesting opportunities. They want to use waste coal. The state of Pennsylvania probably has the largest resource in the form of waste coal of any of the states in the country. It's basically the tailings when they try to lower the ash content of coal. What they do is they make a high ash content waste and a low ash content feed. That high ash content waste has calorific value. And what the state of Pennsylvania has been doing is developing and working with technology developers to advance the use of that raw material in electric power production. And they just recently, they spearheaded an effort to build the North America's largest waste coal utilizing power plant. It's called Seward, and it's from the Reliant company. And they basically now demonstrated that there is a technology for using waste coal. But all it does is use waste coal to produce electric power, and the efficiency is still in the electric power kind of efficiency range. We can use waste coal and elevate it into our kind of high efficiency process and basically derive a lot of benefit. And finally, on economic viability. So their major objectives, and this is something we're hoping the state of Alaska will articulate, their major objectives for a pioneer project in Pennsylvania: establish truly clean coal industry using state's resources. They want to mitigate Susquehanna wastewater problems, and they want to use biofertilizers, which is something I'm going to tell you we're doing. It's a very interesting spin on all this, and it's the essential feature in our carbon capture recycle system. They want to maximize utilization of waste coal. They want to do CO2 mitigation, not by burying it, but by using it. They want to basically produce basic transportation, gasoline, diesel in Pennsylvania, but they're also fully on board with our program with DOD. And finally, and most importantly, especially in today's economic environment, they want to produce secure domestic jobs, the kind of jobs that actually stay where you create them. They don't just migrate away to China, India, or elsewhere. And to create a new industrial base, basically to bring coal out of the pure electric power play market and into the clean synthetic fuels market. And this is the topic we've been pushing very hard on. We know, and we're under no illusion, it will not be easy to do that in the U.S. There are too many self-interest groups who don't like coal for all host of reasons, probably a lot of those reasons justified based on past experience. The problem is introducing a new concept that tries to overcome those old problems has still got a challenge to it. And that's what we're trying to do. We think the challenge is worthwhile, and basically the state in Pennsylvania has been very accommodative in trying to do that. So our integrated demo unit and the integrated commercial projects in Pennsylvania would incorporate all three key process steps. The CO2, interestingly, which we capture and use to produce algae, would have three basic outlets, either as the oil into the upgrading for isoparaffins, or the biomass into gasification for the cycloparaffins, or the third outlet now, which is biofertilizer. And it turns out in a study that we just completed, and we will release to you all probably in the next week or two from the DOE, in a study that we just completed on the so-called life cycle analysis of this process, this outlet ends up being one of the key enablers to not only minimize land use, but to get into some very, very interesting positive benefits with regard to food production. And basically what it's saying is the algae, depending on the algae that you produce, and we will produce something called blue-green algae. That algae can also be used after it's dried and mixed with conventional fertilizer in about a 4-to-1 ratio of conventional fertilizer and biofertilizer blended. That the studies so far have shown that that combination, because of the unique way in which this material operates, boosts average crop yields 20% to 30%. And we'll get into the details at some other point, but suffice it to say, by using a material derived from the CO2 from this process, we're able to achieve a 30-fold multiplier in the atmospheric CO2 uptake, specifically and uniquely ascribable to that product. So we have now, in Pennsylvania, and it's been a whirlwind, but a very successful and gratifying one, we've made agreements with Pennsylvania State University to do the full land testing and field testing of our biofertilizer, with the University of Pittsburgh to do the full process engineering modeling on this, and with Carnegie Mellon to do an econometric model. And they're doing that, and it'll answer your question, Senator, on the jobs creation in a couple slides. But to look at really what would be the impact of actually building one of these at small scale first, 8,000 barrels a day in the state of Pennsylvania, on jobs, on food production, and on fuel production. And we're purposely pushing each of these buttons, all right, in those four key areas. We just keep pushing on those because we believe at the end of the day, for this technology to be successful, it needs to be very successful in all four of those performance criteria. So on this chart you get, and this is something we will be sharing more and more with you, Senator, and the other folks here in Alaska, is what we're learning and what we're doing in Pennsylvania. We think it will be useful for you either to consider and dismiss or to consider and perhaps assimilate. But what we're doing in Pennsylvania is, in our case, an integrated system that may not be applicable here, but elements of it are. We're integrating our ICBTL scheme with one of two major power plants there, either the so-called Bruce Mansfield, it's one of the largest coal-fired power plants in North America, 2.5 gigawatts of power from coal, or the Seward waste coal to power plant. We will integrate our facility with that structure, use the processed CO2 both from the power plant and from our facility, and offset both CO2 streams so that the integrated facility will have a virtually nil CO2 footprint based on the ICBTL flow scheme that I just showed you on the previous chart. And the trick to it is the so-called Pteroderm biofertilizer algae co-product that's produced in that process. We've looked at the land use requirements, and to do this for Seward, for example, would take approximately 2,800 acres of biomass farm. That may sound like it's large to you. It's about half the size of the average Kansas wheat farm. It's not very large at all. It's about 5 square miles. So this concept will be demoed initially at demo scale, and then ultimately, we hope, at full integrated pioneer scale in Pennsylvania. We think this concept, X the power plant, can also be suitable here in Cook Inlet and also be very suitable for producing the military spec fuels. We have those studies I mentioned with the various universities underway now and the state DEP, and basically all of that is to quantify the technology, the economics, and the environmental aspects of this, and to have the state, not us, be the ones that certify it. On financing for Pennsylvania, they've actually taken, and we're not proposing this to Alaska at all, but they've taken the lead on this, and the state, in the case of the Seward project, and we believe here also, will secure 50% of the project financing with state bonds, and we and the project developers will be responsible for the other 50%. The pre-qual work needs to be done to ExxonMobil standards, and that will be done either with Foster, Wheeler, Bechtel, or Siemens. That part of this, actually, you can see it here. So we're in this phase right now. Basically, the feasibility study, pre-qual, and program validation are what we're doing right now. This part of the work on pre-feed and feed and EPC will be done with a project developer, and in the case of Pennsylvania, will be done with them as an intimate partner in arranging for, ultimately, the project developer to enjoy the benefit of 50% of project sponsorship out of the state. The sort of jobs creation that we've teed up here, and this is for an notional 8,000 barrel a day facility that is the coal conversion and the biofertilizer production, is basically shown here. There's actually a more detailed chart here, which you can look at your leisure. This is being verified now at Carnegie Mellon, and I can tell you their initial look says these numbers are roughly correct. So a single project, permanent jobs, this is not the peak construction, which hits around 2,500 or 2,800, depending on whose numbers you use. But the base project will create 700 permanent jobs with an average salary of around, in lower 48, so I don't know what it is up here, but in Pennsylvania-type talk, of around $70,000 a year. It's a meaningful dent. It's not the ultimate solution, but certainly a meaningful dent in creating a meaningful industry in the U.S. and permanent jobs here. So this is now all being verified in the modeling work that's out of our hands and is now being done at Carnegie Mellon University. If you look at sort of more macroeconomics, if you look at our technology, which I said has the higher efficiencies, if you were only to take 1% of the world's coal reserves and use it into fuels over a 30-year period using our concept versus, for example, the Sasol concept, a couple things are immediately obvious to you. You produce 2 times more fuel, at least 4 barrels versus 2 per ton of coal. And each year that, on this basis, which I think we were figuring crude at maybe $70-ish or $80 a barrel, would generate an additional $16 billion worth of domestic energy, meaning money that would not go from the U.S. outside to bring something here to burn, and would also generate over, this is a weird way of saying it, but over 230 million tons less CO2 than you would have in the base case. So on any of the performance attributes that folks typically measure these things by, we think this is a pretty good deal. I'm not here to make a pitch. It will sound like it at some times. What I am here to tell you is the basic platform now represents state-of-the-art for coal conversion. It does it in an economically viable way, we believe. We're having that tested by outside parties. It does it in a way that's environmentally sensitive, meaning that at a minimum the greenhouse gas requirements are met. The other emissions from the plant are innocuous. What otherwise in a coal-fired power plant would be fly ash, in our plant is a non-leachable grit. It's been proven to be useful in either construction materials or in other applications where grit, actually there is a market for grit, sells about $20 a ton, where there are applications for that. The sulfur comes out as elemental sulfur, not as gaseous sulfur oxides in otherwise plant emissions that may come out of coal-fired power plants. And ultimately, it uses, as the ultimate feed, either coal or coal biomass or coal natural gas. And we've even got some interesting ideas around here for unique ways of using coal plus natural gas in this context. The idea for, we think, for Cook Inlet and for Asia Pacific, I just summarized those, but that it does, in fact, it is responsive to the 4 key performance criteria. We think, and we will be working harder now with Department of Defense to more formalize the plan for Alaska. We just finished an internal strategy meeting this past week, and Excelergy has concluded that we don't have the bandwidth, frankly, to do more. There will be two major project proposals for us going forward. One will be Pennsylvania and the integrated Cuyahoga Liquids Project, and the other on the initial suite will be Alaska, Cook Inlet. And we will take those as far as we can, and if we see that we can no longer take them forward, we will simply drop them. But right now we're energized, and we think we can take both of those proposals forward. And we're going to look for your support, not necessarily financial, although initially we're going to make you demonstrate that you're at least interested in what we're talking about, slightly interested, or, you know, want to at least learn a little more. And then as we go through the work with TARDEC and AFRL, and probably by next week with the Navy Research Labs, we think we'll be able to very nicely convince you of the merits of this from a U.S. Energy Security Department of Defense perspective. And then eventually, we hope, as we roll out these other studies, more formally convince you in the other performance attributes. What we've done with Tayonek is we have already developed an MOU with them, and we've got a plan in place, and we're collaborating with our lower 48 partners in Montana. So from a programmatic point of view, we've already taken care of the liaison between Alaska and the lower 48, and we will be doing some additional work to flange this up for the white paper that probably you all would benefit from. We are planning ultimately, and this is probably bad to tell you because it'll relieve the strain on you, but we are planning to do some work to get some form of Alaskan jet fuel into the AFRL TARDEC program, because we frankly think that that's important to do in its own right. Bless you. So we will be doing that probably regardless of your response to our request, but what I will tell you is a positive response to our request will help us a lot justify and accelerate the focus on Alaska. And that's really something for you all to decide. We have started in the lower 48 an education program with the Crow Nation, and we've already talked about liaising with the University of Alaska and others, and that program is underway. Senator Baucus helped sponsor that for us, and we just launched that initiative. But we are sincere in our desire to try to train local folks into the kind of technology areas and jobs opportunities that exist here. The proposal that will be coming your way is what we call a stage gate approach. We never ask for a commitment more than what we think our management would approve. So we have a three-step process of getting through an initial feasibility study, laboratory scale testing, and then ultimately pilot scale testing. But basically our objective for Tayonek and for the Cook Inlet initiative is to get the local coal run through and produced up in a form that can go through Tier 1, Tier 2 testing at the Air Force Research Labs in Dayton. That's a very critical first step. We need to know that the molecules are right. We can tell you they will probably be right, but Exxon certainly will not sign off until we actually show them that they're right. And then later, we get into the whole DOD think around defining the requirements, structuring the RFP, and all of that, so that we can formalize with Elmendorf an initiative to get Elmendorf as one of the square customers lined up for taking offtake contract on the fuel that we're going to get certified. So I have 6 minutes left to entertain any questions, and that'll be good. So thank you all for your attention.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Rocco, for your presentation and interest in Alaska. It's great to hear that we're one of the states that you're looking at putting your effort in. And although we are not the selection committee for the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, obviously we are energy leaders and have influence in the community and want to continue to support you and welcome you to our state, and whatever it is that we can do to help in regulatory burdens and things like that, please keep in touch with us. When will you be back to Alaska again?
At the rate it's going, probably on my way to Beijing in a month.
Okay, great. Well, we look forward to talking with you again. Perhaps we could get a smaller group of us together and sort of catch up on what's happened so far, and by then maybe we'll have results from the Emerging Energy Fund. I know Representative Peterson had a question, and then Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had mentioned, talked at great length about the what you're going to do with the CO2 emissions, and you briefly mentioned the sulfur. I didn't hear anything about the mercury emissions that come from coal. Have you got that worked out?
Well, we think we have it worked out. In the particular flow scheme that we utilize, the way it basically breaks down is into solid, gas, and liquid emissions. The water that we produce is reprocessed through the process sequence, and basically the water effluent that comes out of the facility, based on earlier work done at Exxon, has already been certified for introduction into trout streams, which, and I don't know what the rules are here, but in lower 48, if you can introduce it into a trout stream, that is a almost pinnacle level of purity, because trout are hypersensitive to bad things. So the water has been tested and shown to be applicable to trout stream disposal. The solids that come out of this facility are a glass-like aggregate, which contain any and all of the inorganic components that were originally present in the coal. The technology crudely is referred to as a slagging gasifier, and basically we try to minimize it, but we use that facility to literally melt all of the inorganics. And as they come out, and I didn't bring a sample, I should have, but it literally forms what looks like little sand crystals. They're not. They're little coal residue crystals. And that's been shown in EPA testing to be a non-leachable solid. And it does contain all of these constituents that you're concerned with. We're concerned with, too. There is a question as to, the only question I would say that is legitimate, and we won't know until we produce them and actually store them for 30 or 40 years, is whether or not they devitrify, that they disintegrate.
Right.
But at the point of what we've done and what others have done, they've shown that they're basically glass-like materials that are very, very stable. And we're actually pretty convinced, but as I said, you need to make them and store them that long to be certain of that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yep.
Representative Miller.
Thanks. I have a question. You made a statement earlier that caught my ear. You were talking about the special interest groups having conflict with coal. Are you doing anything currently to mitigate it, and have you had any specific groups forming against your process in North Dakota or Pennsylvania or any other places that you've...
We actually, what we did initially in Pennsylvania and now, and it will be a model probably for how we go forward, is we wait until we have all of the information secured for that specific, in the case of Pennsylvania, for the ICBTL Pioneer plant. And right now, I think we're maybe a few weeks away from locking in on whether it'll be the Mansfield Power Plant or whichever of the specific site-specific issues it'll be. But once we settle on that, we will take our process modeling and that information together, and we will start a discussion with the DEP first. They are, let me say, representative of the think, which is good. Environmental think is good. But they are representative of it in a way that also tries to take into account the state's interest in all these other issues we talked about. Once we clear that hurdle, our plan is to go to the local Sierra Club reps, et cetera, and literally to present the package and to see what sort of objections they have. Obviously, as you know, I'm sure, that there can be all sorts of litigation associated with these kind of initiatives. And this is where a lady named Katie McGinty, who was the head of the state DEP in Pennsylvania, took a terrific leadership role in the Seward project. And she negotiated that with the environmental groups to a point where now, I think, Seward is looked at as a great success. And it's all the cost benefits and alternatives of, do you leave waste coal piles in Pennsylvania and suffer all the consequences of that, or do you process it and then look at that world? And you look at those two worlds, and the environmentalists said, yes, this is a better world than this. So it's never going to be easy with coal. It's just not in the U.S. So our plan is to do a very methodical approach and then to not confront them, but share with them what we're planning to do. If they have bona fide objections, try to address those. If they don't, meet them in court and try to work it through. That's all we can do.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Thanks for coming up as well.
We learned the last time we sat around this table, I think it was the Energy Committee, when we were talking to the Department of Natural Resources, about going through the process. A company like yours coming here and going through the regulatory and legislative process, and you've been successful in other states, obviously. I guess this is more of a plea to you. We were told last time that issues that arose within departments were having a hard time getting up to the governor's office and having problems solved. And the response was, well, companies can come and talk to you, and you can introduce legislation. I guess that's a warning as you go through this process. Can you be very proactive in letting the chair know and the other members of this committee know when you run into roadblocks, and don't assume that the regulatory people that you're dealing with are going to run it up the flagpole within the administration? I'm very frustrated with the answers I got last time. And I think all of us around the table hopefully are here to help get you through this process.
If that was us, I'm totally unaware of...
Not you. It was a different group. Through the chair. It was a different group. And
we actually, frankly, try to follow what the U.S. consulate in Shanghai told us, that U.S. energy policy is dictated by politics in this country. It is.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
not a bad thing.
Unfortunately.
But we try to be very responsive to that. So I totally welcome your point. And we will, I think, hopefully you'll find us to be a model of how to do it. We've been very successful in Montana, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, and in Washington. And we hope to be equally successful with you all. Absolutely. You guys are critical. I mean, you're it, right? You're it.
Yeah, indeed. It's just frustrating. Don't fall into the trap that when a department person tells you they're going to run it up the pole,
that they
get
will.
It done, that they will. Make sure you let us know, because we've had other companies turned away and get frustrated and go through all sorts of problems, and we don't even know about it.
Now, we will try to be model citizens that way, and hopefully if y'all are any bit like the guys in the lower 48, it should be a good venture.
May I have one more quick question?
Sure.
As you've gone through other states and now you're entering into Alaska's political arena and the regulatory arena, is it obvious the path that you need to go into Alaska to find the right energy person within the administration, or have you found, maybe you're talking to two or three different people on other issues, we've had some confusion with people who are trying to work with the state? Are you satisfied?
I would say no. Very good point. I would say, so I have I'm split personality on this, so I'm sort of operating in two spaces. I have a lot of experience with the state of Alaska from my days at ExxonMobil. We actually teed up a number of very serious projects here. We spent very serious effort looking at them, and I had only good experiences with that group, for right or wrong. It was a good experience. Since I've been out of ExxonMobil and into the, let's say, more venture-oriented world, I've had more of a mixed bag of reflections and reactions, which I have ascribed more the nature of the community than to the state of Alaska, because at least in my deep-seated memory bank, I know the state of Alaska can function very well and can be very rigorous, and it can be a very good thing. But I would say from a smaller company point of view, and maybe not having all the full balanced portfolio of expertise that you would need, I can see where it could go wrong. So I would say the reality is that there are probably a lot of companies more like us than there are Exxon. And any guidance you all can and feedback you can give us on how to make it a better and more efficient process is going to be helpful to everyone. You should want, I know you do, the best technology options to be afforded to you, and we're hoping to bring one, and there will be undoubtedly other folks, but getting through the process, having you help us and us help you get through that process of assessment is going to be very critical.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And these are maybe somewhat technical questions, and thanks again for your interest. How long does it take to certify, and do you have to certify every aircraft type? And
no, we actually had a very good discussion with the fellow who heads up AFRL right now, Tim Edwards. In the past, in order to do this, you actually had to go through 20 individual aircraft for certification.
Right.
We probably, in our program that I outlined before, we will probably be the first group that goes through three aircraft certification. And they've basically worked it based on engine system, the thermal management versus fuel performance characteristics. They've worked down to where I think the C-17 is one of them, B-2 is one of them, and the F-22 is one of them. We're lobbying actually to get a fourth aircraft, which is F-35, only because it happens to play to our strength. But they're, at the moment, they're neutral on that. Those other three are the base JP-8 certification platforms.
And if a follow-up, JP-8, is that the battlefield fuel?
It is. What AFRL calls JP-8 is what TARDAC calls the, quote, universal battlefield fuel.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, and if I don't, am I on the record? I am on the record, so I shouldn't tell my funny story. But I will tell you later how the Army wanted us to indemnify them from the use of our fuel, to which our attorney said, don't they put this in tanks?
Well, and that was the question. So do you have to certify this for everything from a Humvee, or are you
told
that yes, and then everything goes
similar
closed down,
yes,
down?
Protocol. The way AFRL is now doing it, which TARDAC will, based on our discussions with them, they will also follow this. They're building test platforms that take you through what's called a thermal management cycle, meaning heating, cooling, oxygen, not oxygen, et cetera, and looking at stability in that simulation. AFRL has literally built, it's a terrific room, it's a room about this size, and they have an F-22 room that has all of the individual components that are in an F-22 fight. Actually, they fly out of Elmendorf, I think, that take you through the simulated use on an aircraft, and they run it for 1,000 hours, and then they look at the fuel at the end of that, as I showed you.
Just a couple of, and Jet A fuel is different than JP, so what's the difference in that for when you start putting it in the airplanes out of
JP 8 has a few additional sort of military specs superimposed on Jet A. In fact,
temperature, I know,
yeah,
a lot
thermal
of
that. Right. It has to do, right. It just has to do with the way in which a fighter aircraft uses fuel versus a commercial aircraft.
Right. And so I guess my question is, what do we have to do to sell commercial fuel versus military fuel
if
in
you
your
meet
process?
If you meet JP-8 spec, you essentially meet Jet A spec.
And then the last question, time for certification.
Okay, in a case of what we're doing, we have two parts. One part we've already met. We meet something called ASTM D7566, which is a mouthful. But that's the current synthetic jet fuel standard, meaning you can take our fuel today and blend it with 50% petroleum fuel and use it. That's essentially...
You can do that with Fisher Cove or anything.
Yeah.
If
not,
you blend it, you're okay because of the seats and stuff.
You got it. Exactly right. We can do that today, so that part's already met. What we're now trying to do with AFRL is get to what will be the next ASTM, which doesn't exist yet, which will be our fuel... certified as fully, literally, that you can use it without any other additives. And that, they tell us, first quarter of 2013. The 1Q 2013.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions from the committee members? Representative Seaton, are you still online?
Yes, I am. Appreciated the presentation. Thank you very much. I don't have any questions at this time.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Rocco and Don, for being here. We really appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you in a month to get some updates from you. And with that, I will adjourn the Special Committee on Energy at 3:11.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you.